Good morning and welcome to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. I'm your host, Lee Smith. This morning, we have the book of the moment that matters. Very exciting to be welcoming our two guests here, Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka. And the book of the moment is, as you've seen, with the campus protest erupting all across the country, Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka, thanks so much for being here this morning. Welcome to you both. Congratulations on the book. Catherine, what kind of response are you getting to the book right now? I mean, people must be thrilled to have an explanation of what's happening.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it's really been so... sadly timely that it came out right now with these crazy protests. And what I find in particular, I mean, of course, you know, media podcasters, they've been very interested. We've been doing a lot of media, but, you know, I also talk to a lot of groups of regular people, right? I was recently elected as the chair of the Fairfax County GOP. So I'm frequently talking to voters and just parents and grandparents. And I find they particularly appreciate it because they are just baffled at what they are seeing. They are baffled by some of the things they hear coming from their children. But just as importantly, they want to know whether there's something that they can do about this or are they powerless? And a really important aspect of our book is that we say you absolutely are not powerless. There's a lot you can do, and we lay out what it is people can do, and I think they really welcome that.
Mike, what can we do? What can parents do? What can audience members do?
Well, what they have been doing, since the beginning of 2021, which is going to school boards, speaking up, saying either on the racial or the sexual issues, and saying, why are you teaching our children to hate based on race, or why are you teaching our children that they can change sex and they can have they should have these grotesque procedures, medical procedures practiced on them as minors? Parents are exercising their right, and not just parents, is a lot of people are also fighting against what is happening in their workplaces, either the office or the factory floor, all these quote-unquote anti-racism trainings, which are nothing more than the struggle sessions of the cultural Marxists that Katie and I identify and spell out in our book. Our book really has been, as Katie said, more timely than we realized it was going to be for very unfortunate reasons. Because we explain exactly, I've been watching TV during these last few weeks, and commentators are asking, why is this happening? Why is this happening at our major universities? And really, Katie and I wrote the book. So parents are taking, they're calling professors, they're calling teachers, they're calling principals. They're taking matters into their own hands, but they need our help. They need the help of the political class, whether that means elected officials, or that means those of us who are fortunate enough to have a voice. They need the help of activists. They need the help of journalists. And some journalists are doing really good work. The Washington Free Beacon is doing good work. The Washington Examiner, for which I'm a weekly columnist, is doing good work. The Daily Signal is doing good work. Fox does good work. You guys do good work. You do great work. So, the American people are acting, they have woken up to the woke, but they need our help.
Katie, if you can explain exactly what is, I mean, you know, here at Epoch Times, I mean, we do a lot on the Communist Chinese Party, the dangers, evils of communism are very important to us here, as they are and should be to all Americans. But what is next gen Marxism? What do you guys mean by that?
So this is an important distinction. And just to be clear, in case people feel like, oh, but I've never heard that term before, it's because Mike and I came up with it. We felt that we needed a name for this new phenomenon. So just very, very briefly, you know, the original Marxism was really focused on the worker as being the oppressed class who would rise up in a revolution and destroy the bourgeoisie, the owners, right, the oppressors. But that has changed. So today, you know, they still work with this very Marxist notion of two distinct classes, oppressor and oppressed. But today, the oppressor is basically whites and anybody they consider white adjacent. So it's Jewish people, it's many Asian people, but it's, you know, primarily white people. And I should say anybody sort of who might be considered a colonizer, that's become a very big thing in these recent weeks on the campuses. And the oppressed are any minority group, whether, you know, based on race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender concepts, or, you know, minority groups internationally, like a smaller group that people may argue have been colonized. So that's the new next gen Marxism.
All right. This is interesting because I did want to come to the protests. And you guys have laid out the history of what's happened here. So are you not surprised by what we're seeing on college campuses from west to east, north to south? Mike, is this something that, we saw some of it right after October 7th, astonishingly, that there were pro-Hamas protests out there doing that. But the sheer rage, the sheer fury that we've seen the last month, Mike, is this something that surprised
you? No, not in the least. I mean, Katie and I talked about it. In fact, we talk about it in our books. We talked because we were able to write about what happened after October 7th. We finished the book in late 2023. So, look, it's not surprising because, as Katie said, through the third iteration of Marxism, which is the first one is Marx, the economic Marx, then the cultural Marxism, and then the American more racial and sexual in community organizing oriented next gen Marxism. Throughout these important evolutions, they have kept the original Marxian idea of all of life can be boiled down to an epic struggle between the oppressed and the oppressor. They just have changed, and they really change at will, right? Sometimes white women will be oppressors. Sometimes white women will be oppressed. Yeah. If you're white, it's less to do with race. If you're a white ally, you're not an oppressor anymore. You become an ally. When they talk about white supremacy, it really is it's Western culture. It's a synonym. Robin DiAngelo is very specific in one of her books. She says that to talk about white supremacy as only meaning white supremacy, it's too reductive. She actually uses those terms. It's too reductive. White supremacy is our culture, which is nothing to do with whiteness. It's to do with America, who we are. And that is because they believe in this deeply. They have put the Israeli and ergo all the Jews in the category of the oppressor. And they have put the Palestinian in the category of the oppressed. And once you're in the category of the oppressed, that justifies all manner of action. That justifies all acts of cruelty. Right. They're allowed to do whatever they want. So we have the perverse outcome that you see these college students, and they have been doing this now for months, celebrating the terrorist attack on Israel and disdaining or deriding the victims, including women who were gang raped by Hamas. So given that that Katie and I had an intrinsic understanding of this ideology, which is not just fallacious, but it's also evil, because it justifies many evils, we're not surprised at all by this, sadly.
I'd like to add, if I could, you know, we talk in the book not just about the history of the ideas, which is in itself very, very important, just to understand the evolution of the ideology and how we've gotten to where we are. But it's also, you know, what we also really unpacked was the sort of strategies and techniques that have been used so effectively by the radical left. So, I mean, it really starts with Lenin. Marxism was a failure for its first 70 years, but Lenin kind of came up with this magic formula, which was he came to figure out that if you can use information and propaganda to make people feel aggrieved and victimized, and then you organize them, you can bring about a revolution, right? This was Lenin's magic formula. Now, what's interesting about it was Saul Alinsky, right, the big organizer and started in Chicago and then went elsewhere, but the American leftist organizer kind of took this basic principle and made it uniquely American. He came up, you know, Rules for Radicals is basically Lenin translated for the United States, right? And it was kind of elaborated. This formula has been used down through the decades and kind of honed and perfected, you know, organizing, the way they organize, the way they get into the grassroots, the way they push a certain narrative. I mean, look, we've all seen the footage of these kids on these campuses. When you press them and ask them, what are you protesting against? Most of them can't articulate a single intelligent sentence. They don't know why they're there. But you know why they're there? Because they're being organized. You know, the that whole meme about the fact that all the tents are the same brand of tent, you know, and this is one of the things that we really, really get into is looking at the role of both sort of many of our enemies, you know, the role of Russia, China, Iran, European Marxists, Latin American Marxists, how they engaged in the United States to sort of foment our own radical movements. You know, we draw ties directly between them and the origins of Black Lives Matter, the fact that Palestinians were present at many of those early meetings, the fact that Black Lives Matter leaders went to, you know, meet with Palestinians. These things have been intertwined for a long time. And I think this has to be the focus right now.
I wanted to get a little more detail on that because that seems really important. Where did Black Lives Matter officials meet with Palestinians? Is that here on U.S. campuses or where is that?
So it happened, it actually begins to happen. Well, as Katie and I document this, we have already Palestinians show up at the founding conference of the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta in 2007, we already have a strong Palestinian contingent. Where part of the platform is against Israel, and they call the founding of Israel the Nakba, the whatever that's the tragedy. I think it's translated into English, and that was organized. One of the organizers of that conference was Eric Mann, the former weatherman terrorist who recruited Patrice Cullors, the founder, one of the architects of BLM. She was there also in Atlanta in 2007. So was Alicia Garza in Atlanta in 2007. This is the founding conference of the U.S. Social Forum, which is a very Marxist international global network. But then, as Katie said, about a contingent of about 200 Palestinians show up in Ferguson. So 2007, just to put in the historical context, it's 6 years before the founding of Black Lives Matter, you know, 5 years before Trayvon Martin ever comes across George Zimmerman and tragically dies, and in 6 years before a jury in Florida acquits George Zimmerman, which is the triggering event for the founding of Black Lives Matter. And then Black Lives Matter becomes a global network in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, after the death of Michael Brown, when you had all the riots there in 2014. And there you have contingents of Palestinians show up. And lo and behold, that ends. Ferguson kind of peters out in December 2014. Mm-hmm. In late January 2015, barely weeks after, you have Patrice Cullors in the West Bank, having been invited there by a terrorist group, by a group that is linked to a Syrian-based terrorist group, and she is there. The videos can be found online, where she spouts anti-Israel slogans, and she calls Israel a white settler state, and all these things. So that is that's very concrete evidence of the nexus between Palestinians and BLM.
That is fascinating. I want to come back. We have to take a quick break, but I want to come back to that after the break, because of course, this is something that we saw in the 1960s. We saw all this coordination with the Palestinians, with all sorts of radical groups throughout Europe, throughout the United States, Japanese radical groups as well. So that's something I want to pick up when we come back. I want to ask about the continuity between the 1960s and today. In the meantime, all of you, I have to recommend this once again, a very important book, timely book. This is a book that matters. Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka, these are our guests today. If you're watching on YouTube, please, we're cutting away to Epoch TV exclusively after the jump. Make the jump with us to Epoch TV exclusively. We'll see you in less than a minute. Mr. Roger Stone, really one of the grand masters of political strategy. He's going to be speaking about a book today that came out about 2 years ago.
Manafort was not, of course, charged with any crime that had anything to do with Donald Trump or the Trump campaign.
The author of this book, Paul Manafort, was part of the Trump team who was targeted by the FBI, the Clinton campaign, and Obama spy chiefs.
They dusted off 15-year-old business investigations that they had previously closed for lack of sufficient evidence or other flaws in those cases.
That links Donald Trump's campaign manager to one of Vladimir Putin's buddies.
They base the success of their entire investigation on the false claim that as Donald Trump's campaign manager, Manafort had given proprietary secret polling information to a man named Konstantin Kalimnik.
And as a result, we now are learning that Manafort met with Russian Konstantin Kilmenik in Madrid while he managed Trump's presidential campaign.
He's absolutely proved that Konstantin Kilmenik is not a Russian intelligence asset. In fact, he's a U.S. intelligence. The special counsel, Andrew Miller, has made certain that Manafort's been put through hell. They moved him from prison to prison to prison. He would be sleeping on cold cement floors in ice-cold cells at some point in his incarceration. Manafort's book is amazing in the sense of his spiritual strength. He talks very openly in the book about how the Bible sustained him, how his faith sustained him.
I'm very moved by what you're saying because, of course, people know that you were put through hell as well. Welcome back to Words That Matter, a Modern Day Book Club. I'm your host, Lee Smith. Next Gen Marxism, a book that matters on words that matter, what it is and how to combat it, Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka. Before the break, Katie, I want to ask you, we were talking about the ties between BLM and Palestinian activists. Palestinian terror groups, as Mike pointed out before the break. So, Katie, I want to know about what kind of continuity, and you spoke a bit about Saul Alinsky, but how is what we're seeing now on college campuses and activists throughout the country, what sort of continuity do we have between now and the 1960s? Is it different? Or how is next-gen Marxism different from what we saw in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, so one of the things that we found in researching the book is there is a very direct line from the radicalism of the 1960s, and specifically members of Students for a Democratic Society, and what's happening today. And part of it is that, you know, the students got to the end of the 1960s and they felt that their revolution had failed. The two things that they were most fighting for were, so allegedly, the end of the Vietnam War and big changes to civil rights, you know, the situation of civil rights. But they were actually, in fact, Marxists. What they really wanted was the downfall of the United States, and that had not come about, right? So they basically disbanded at the end of the 60s. And those who stayed engaged kind of went one of three directions. Some went full bore terrorism, right? They went into the Weather Underground and conducted a multi-year campaign of bombings and attacks and violence. Some went into the universities, particularly into the field of critical legal studies, because they believed the way they were going to bring down the United States was by basically fundamentally changing the law. And a third group went into organizing. They realized, again, picking up on that Leninist Saul Alinsky model, they realized the only way you're going to bring about the revolution is if you organize, if you get into the grassroots, make people feel aggrieved, and organize them for revolution. And so organizing became a really key piece of this. One of the groups that was formed, one of the key groups, was called the Midwest Training Academy. They formed with Saul Alinsky, guiding them on how to organize. They've been organizing for 50 years. Barack Obama was one of the products of that group. And, you know, there's so much more detail that we could go into. I don't want to overly burden the conversation, but just to say, so many of the people that were there present in the 1960s have their fingerprints all over what we're seeing today, either directly, for example, through like Eric Mann, who then, you know, after being a weather underground, serving time in prison, came out in 1989, he didn't come out of prison, but he started in 1989. He formed an organizing grassroots organization in Los Angeles. And who was one of his early recruits? At the age of 17, Patrice Couleurs was recruited by him, trained by him. So these are the kinds of things you're seeing, as well as using all those organizing techniques.
Yeah, by the way,
Mike...
Recruit is the word that Eric Mann uses himself in a 2011 book, again before the founding of Black Lives Matter. He boasts that he has recruited, or that his organization has recruited, the organization is the Labor Community Strategy Center, has recruited this brilliant organizer by the name of Patrice Couleurs. He uses the word recruit. And I was just looking in the book for the organization that brought Couleurs to the Middle East. It was in 2015, just weeks after Ferguson, and that's on page 216 of Next Gen Marxism. It was Dream Defenders, which is associated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which the director of national intelligence calls a Syria-based terrorist group. So that is, you have it there. You can find it on page, buy the book, and look at page 216 for that connection. Sorry, Lee, go ahead.
No, it's great. Look, what I want to know, I'll ask Katie first. Okay, so Next Gen Marxism. If the instrument is Marxism, what's the end state? What does communism, is it communism? Is it chaos? Is it just is it an oligarchy under the name of communism, where we see the different oligarchs now, whether it's from George Soros to Mark Zuckerberg to Bill Gates, who have just imposed an insane system. So what is the end state? What are the next gen Marxist radicals working toward? Katie, you first, please.
I would actually argue that, in fact, Marxism is itself the end state, because I see Marxism less as a set of techniques than I do see it as it's really a worldview. It's really an understanding of the world, which sees the world as fundamentally divided and irreconcilable, and it's obsessed with power. And so the end state that they desire, I don't even think they have a coherent plan for, we want the government to control more of the economy. No, I think all they're out for is to try to bring down the U.S. government, the U.S. system. They want power. What they'd actually do with it when they get it, I don't even think they know. They want power. And that's about as clearly articulated as you can get.
Yeah, I think
that's fascinating. Mike,
Katie puts it very, very, very well. Marx, from the beginning, they're much more explicit about what they want to destroy and much less explicit about what they want to create. So they hate us. They hate Western civilization. Mark Alinsky famously dedicates his book, Rules for Radicals, to Lucifer, because Lucifer is the first revolutionary and he establishes his own kingdom. Never mind that what he establishes is actual hell. It shows you that they haven't really thought it through. But they, what I would say that because they all hate capitalism, and by the way, they have the slogan that if you study these nutty groups, I've been studying who's organizing the college protests and who's funding them. And there's a group in Westchester, New York. And if you click on their page, you come to a photo of earnest looking activists, and they have a banner that says another world is possible. And that's a complete dog whistle. Every time you hear that, you're talking to you're talking about communists and Marxists. Another world is possible. They don't want to come out and say, look, I'm a communist. I want gulags. I want repression. I want bread lines. I want collectivism and central planning. But they do want these things because they are against capitalism. Capitalism mainly says, I own this. Katie wants to buy it. And Katie and I agree on a price. And we both walk away happy. That's capitalism. They don't like that. So we can rest. And they don't like representative democracy either. So we can rest assured that what they want is the opposite of that, which is gulags and bread lines and repression.
I want to come back to something you said, Katie, because I thought it was fascinating. Because I think that what you're describing was not just a political doctrine, but a spiritual condition, right? Because you're talking about a faction that's always oppositional, that always sees itself in opposition, and it's the destructive faction. It must continue to pull things down. And so in that way, right, there is no real end state. And as Mike was saying, the end state of communism has always been very hazy, right? All these different cliches coming from Karl Marx himself. So if the fundamental issue is, and maybe I'm misreading you, but if a big issue is that it's a spiritual condition, how do we address that? If it's not just a political debate or a political fight that we're involved in, what do we do if there are people who are, this is the way that they choose to live? And frankly, I think a lot of people are very comfortable in chaos. They're most comfortable in chaos than they are in stable communities or stable families. How do we address that?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. You know, I mean, if I think about it as well, I often think of Marxism as the politics of envy as well. And the politics of anger. And I guess, okay, that's on the one side. On the other side, I think that there is a belief. I do think people believe, as they did in the days of communism, although I think this is kind of fundamentally different, what we're seeing now. You know, in the early days of communism, especially after the success of the Bolshevik Revolution, there were people who truly believed this would be a kinder, fairer way to run the world, right? For the world to be organized. And it was only the reality of it that ultimately proved that so wrong, right? And I always remember there was a great Hungarian economist named Janos Kornai, and he wrote a really fascinating book about his own life. And he was one of those people who said, you know, he was Jewish. The Communist Party was the first time he felt he was accepted. Even though he was Jewish, he was not discriminated against. That was very attractive. He thought that it would be a kinder, you know, gentler way to organize the economy. And it was only when a good friend of his came back from the gulag and described the way the communists were treating people that he started his awakening and started to reject the Communist Party. And I can only think that that's going to be our real salvation here, is that I think that, and I think it's maybe already happening. I don't know. I keep thinking that we've peaked and we haven't. Like, it's so much worse now than it was even 2 weeks ago, right? But I just have to think that there will be an awakening. People will start to see, oh my gosh, this movement that we've created and supported, it actually destroys people. It eats people up. And because that is the other thing that it does. They don't just go after our side. They will start to eat themselves. And that will, I think, be a great awakening. I hope.
Right. They may even eat themselves before they come after the other side. Mike, what does the future look like, especially in line with the book that you guys wrote? I mean, I know it's not a It's not a pamphlet of a rosy-eyed pamphlet, but what is your, you know, what does the future look like? What does the immediate future look like for America in the political struggle we're talking about?
I'm optimistic. To say that let's get up and take a victory lap or celebrate anything. There's a lot of hard work to do. It's going to be a political fight. It's going to be a fight of ideas. Fight of ideas are you have to be engaged in them. You have to you have to be smarter than the other side, and you also have to figure out how to have the right message. Having said all that, I think it's very clear to me, and I think also to Katie, that we have the American people on our side. That the American people have woken up to what is happening. They don't like, even before we had the clashes at UCLA and the craziness at Columbia and NYU, and the American people, and before they were horrified by the reactions to October 7th, we had the American people horrified by what they were trying to, what the government, what the people in authority, what the gatekeepers of the cultural institutions were trying to do to their children by making them seethe because of a racial past or because of sexual ideas that 5 years ago would have been laughed out of town. The fact that that we don't have two sexes. The American people have common sense. Common sense is common. It's not common on the campuses of our Ivy League institutions sometimes because of the people they recruit and the people they admit. But it is common if you travel the country, and I travel the country, I crisscross the country constantly. So does Katie. And the people are with us. So I'm very optimistic because that usually, you change the climate of opinion. Milton Friedman used to say, you change the climate of opinion and even the bad politicians will do the right thing. If the climate of opinion is going in your direction, I think the climate of opinion is going in our direction. We have to keep pushing, put our shoulder to that boulder, and keep pushing it uphill. But I'm not letting up. Neither is Katie.
Mike Gonzalez, Catherine Cornell Gorka, the book of the moment that matters: Next Gen Marxism, what it is, and how to combat it. Thanks to the two of you so much for being here with us today on Words That Matter, a modern day book club. And thanks to all of you for watching. We'll see you in our next episode, Words That Matter. God bless you, Mike and Katie, and God bless you all for watching. Thanks.
God bless Epoch Times and you, Lee. Thank you.
A Senate Judiciary Committee friend called me up one day saying, there's something called demand justice that's all over radio, TV, online, that's attacking all of us. What is it? We discovered that it was a brand new group set up, of course, with George Soros money, and it was going to be attacking every judicial nominee that the administration made. We kept digging, though. It is just a fiscally sponsored project of something called the 1630 Fund. It is one of a half dozen nonprofits run by this for-profit Arabella Advisors outfit.
Can you explain what Arabella is?
Arabella Advisors is a for-profit consulting company that created for itself half a dozen nonprofits. And this whole big network takes in billions of dollars every election cycle and is a player in pretty much every single issue in American politics, even though hardly anybody has heard of it.
The subject matter of the show is certainly going to affect the outcome of the 2024 election and has already affected not only elections, but the way we live. We're cutting away to Epoch TV exclusively. Make sure you make the jump with us.